Members, we're going to get started. My apologies for being late. I had a meeting in my office that went just a tad bit too long, so I apologize for keeping you all waiting. Today, we're going to hear a number of bills that I'm the chair is putting under the theme of Redemption Day. We're going to hear bills related to probation and collateral consequences and clemency in particular. So I'm looking forward to our conversation today. However, at this point, we do have minutes to approve. And I believe, Representative Christensen, you have a motion to approve our February 19th minutes.
Yes, I've become, thank you, Mr. Chair, I've become the minute fixer, I think. On February 19th, we're going to amend the minutes to excuse Jim Nash on that day.
Very well. So the Representative Christensen moves adoption of the February 15th, 2020 minutes with the verbal oral amendment to reflect that Jim Nash's status is excused. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. And then Representative Edelson, if you would be so kind to move the February 20th minutes.
So moved.
Appreciate it.
So moved, Chair.
Very well. Discussion. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. February 20th minutes are adopted. And I'm wondering if Representative Johnson, you would be so kind as to move our hearing minutes of the joint hearing on February 26th. And we talked about this before that, you know, the issue is that in order to get it this into formal records, we have to make a motion, even though it's a joint committee hearing. Thank you. Representative Johnson moves adoption of the February 26th joint committee minutes. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. I greatly appreciate taking care of that business. With that, we're going to start with Representative Long. And Representative Long, you have House File 982. And Representative Long moves that House File 982 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
So moved, Mr. Chair. We heard this bill last year. This is a legislation that Representative Hertzog and I are working on together. I think it's the piece that I know that we've talked most about was the petition for limited relief to allow for limited petitions to the court for specific collateral consequences, which I think we have some broad support for, and so I'm hoping this will remain for consideration.
Very well. And members, this bill, and Representative Long just shared the information. This is the same bill that we heard last year. And so under the 4.20, it's my desire that we honor last year's bills without relitigating the same language. So my intention is to ask us to then move this bill without testimony, debate, or substantive amendment. However, there is a technical amendment. These are going to be typical on these bills because we need to adjust the dates to reflect that we're in a different year. So Representative Long moves adoption of the A2 amendment. Members, all in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. House File 982, as amended, is before us. Any quick questions or thoughts from members? Representative Johnson.
I again have concern about this like last year.
We are on the bill as amended, Representative Johnson.
The key issue that I have last year.
Okay.
First of all, to remove section 169, basically most of 169. Which is the index where all the consequences are located. In the bill, it requires law enforcement, the courts, and everybody to notify what the consequences are of the offense, but it makes it very difficult without the index. So So that makes it very complicated and very difficult and very easy for an officer of the courts to miss it or make a mistake. And going through it quite a bit, it doesn't remove any consequences. So I think that it still needs to be looked at a little more thoroughly and make sure if we're going to do something like this, we do it right. So mistakes are not made. And with that, I would suggest no vote on this bill at this time the way it's currently written.
Excuse me, members. That the water went down the wrong pipe.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson, your objections are noted. I think they were similar to last year's testimony on the record as well. This bill, Representative Long, I believe, is similar to the bill that Representative Herdos presented last year. But if there are any quick comments, and then we'll take action.
I know, Mr. Chair, I think we had a thorough discussion about this bill last year, and I think that there are parts of this bill that would make a big difference. The list is only repealed because it's compiled in another form, and so we're hoping to just collect collateral consequences and provide some limited relief to specific collateral consequences. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Members, Representative Long renews his motion that House File 982, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Long. And then I believe we're taking up your second bill at this point as well. House File 3816. Representative Long settles in. For the record, Representative Long moves House File 3816 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One in four Minnesotans have some type of criminal record, and we know that this is a result of decades of over-criminalization. But in addition to looking on the front end of what we can do to reduce criminalization, we need to also help those with records reintegrate and live successful lives. In the modern digital era, background checks are easy to come by and records are easier than ever to access. Nationwide, nearly 9 in 10 employers use background checks, so do 4 in 5 landlords, so do 3 in 5 colleges. Even with Ban the Box that we have in Minnesota, where criminal records can't be used as a screen for applications, they can still be taken into account in hiring. So the restrictions on jobs, housing, education, credit, insurance, and more place real barriers to reentry. But that's where a clean slate comes in. An expungement seals a criminal record from the public, and Minnesota expunged records can still be accessed by law enforcement and by agencies like DHS for licensing. Currently, to receive an expungement for eligible crimes, an individual has to petition a court. This means they have to, one, know that they are eligible for expungement, and two, hire a lawyer, since they are not public defender eligible. And these barriers mean that very few eligible Minnesotans actually receive expungements. Clean slate is the concept of making the expungement process automatic for certain offenses. A clean slate concept has been spreading across the country. Last year, Utah and Pennsylvania both enacted similar provisions. In Utah, the bill passed unanimously. In Pennsylvania, it passed by a vote of 188-2. What are the benefits of expungement? Well, on the employment side, a California study found that those who had their records expunged saw a $6,000 increase in annual income. A Michigan study found the probability of employment rose by 6.5% and wages rose by 22%. So in a state like ours with a labor shortage, our employers can use all the help they can get. In terms of housing, formerly incarcerated people are nearly 10 times more likely than the general public to experience homelessness. And we also know that this will have a benefit for reducing recidivism rates because post-release employment cuts the recidivism rate by almost half. Expungement also benefits families. Nearly half of all U.S. children have at least one parent with a criminal record. And if those with criminal records find jobs, they can help support children and families and improve family life. We also know that because people of color are disproportionately represented in our criminal justice system, records are a greater burden on their ability to find employment and housing. County Attorney John Choi and County Attorney Mike Orput have shown real leadership in using prosecutor-initiated expungements in their counties, but they have faced real challenges that I'll let County Attorney Choi discuss. Many counties also don't have the resources of metro counties to pursue prosecutor-initiated expungements, which create regional disparities. This bill is simple. It would take our current expungement system that we negotiated in 2015 in the legislature and make it automatic. So for certain low-level offenses where the legislature has already agreed that expungement is appropriate, we would remove the requirement to go to court and instead make it administrative. The waiting period would be 2 years for petty misdemeanors or misdemeanors, as it is under current law, 4 years for gross misdemeanors, and 5 years for certain felonies currently eligible. The felony list is not what folks normally think of when they think of felonies. These are not the most hard-hitting felonies. It includes crimes like movie pirating and altering a livestock certificate, for example, in the enumerated list. Individuals cannot have committed a new crime to be incarcerated at the time, and we also exclude enhanceable crimes until the end of the 10-year waiting period. The BCA would verify eligibility and then notify the courts, which would issue an order sealing the records. The Star Tribune ran a story last year on Ramsey and Washington County's efforts, and they told the story of Catherine Sublette, who was still being denied for apartment applications 30 years after her convictions. Catherine told the Star Tribune, "In all honesty, it stops you from working, it stops you from having a safe place to live, it stops you from living." So that's what we're trying to address here. I want to thank Representative Poston for being a co-author with me on this bill. And I would like to invite up County Attorney Choi as my first testifier.
Very well. Welcome to the committee, County Attorney John Choi. It's good to see my county attorney.
It's welcome. Great to be here and great to see you, Chairman Mariani, and to members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is John Choi, and I am the Ramsey County Attorney. I want to first thank Representative Wong for his leadership in many areas around improving our criminal justice system, and I really believe that the bill before you today in concept is the direction that this state needs to be headed in terms of thinking about how we have more public safety, how we have better quality of justice for all Minnesotans. I believe that at some point we have to have a recognition in this state that punishment has to end when the person who was subject to the sanction has done everything that we have asked them to do, whether it's to serve out their term of probation, if they've been incarcerated, whatever that might be, and they've done everything successfully. We have to, I think, recognize that there is continuing harm for lots of individuals who are trying to re-enter into becoming productive citizens of our state and nation. And I think over the advent of many, many decades, since really the mid-60s, you know, back in the mid-60s, we had no legislatively enacted collateral consequences. But today, there are pages and pages of collateral consequences. And because of the availability of public records and how those records are used today to deny employment, housing, et cetera, that serves as a huge barrier for many, many people. And I think as a value, if we believe, and we are a nation and a country that believes very strongly in that principle of redemption, that we have to think about things like this, the bill that is before you, to think about how we as a society can help people get on with their lives. I want to make sure that people understand that when we talk about expungement, what we're merely talking about is just sealing the public record. And I will say that the public has an interest in knowing about criminal convictions with regard to certain offenses. But you have already taken some legislative action to determine which lists of offenses really there really isn't a public interest for the public to really know about. So I think this bill, and what I really like about it is some of the concepts that are being put into place, because if you talk to the people who are trying to get these expungements, if you just go online and just go to the court's website and take a look at the instructions to get an expungement, those instructions are like, you know, to build your playhouse for your daughter. From the, you know, it's just incredibly difficult to go through all of that. You have to serve all of these people. So we have recognized that we have, in Ramsey County, in Washington County, we've taken the initiative to utilize a law that you passed a number of years ago to allow prosecutors to just go ahead and expunge records based upon what you have authorized. And so we're utilizing that provision in the law, and it's been wildly popular. It's so great to hear from people who have had justice involvement a long time ago, and now they're living very productive lives, but they're still having these barriers in place. And for us to be able to be in a position to help them is really wonderful, because we're helping them ultimately connect to their society to be productive and to be good citizens and parents to their children. So this bill, what it will do, I think it will allow for more ability for people, because if we have to think about things from an equity standpoint, because if you look at the people who might take advantage of our laws today to get an expungement, oftentimes the people who are going to be well-resourced, people who have access to attorneys, people who understand these laws are the ones that are going to be asking for these expungements. What Representative Long's bill does, it puts into motion, I think, a really important concept, and it's being done around the country. California would be a good example, where we're introducing this really important concept of automatic expungements. And so we're still keeping the same time parameters that you have. We're still keeping the same kind of parameters that you have about what types of offenses, but you're allowing for some of these things to be automatically expunged. Now, of course, there's going to be an administrative burden to that, and I think there's a recognition that that is the case, and there's probably some fiscal implications, but I think to have a system like that is going to be more fair, more just for all people across the state. And for many of the automatic expungements, we're talking about very low-level things. If somebody had been diverted and they successfully completed diversion, right, if we can have an automatic way to get to expunging that record, I think that would be really productive for lots of people. There is a study from the University of Michigan that talks about the impact of expungements for people in terms of the economy. 20% increase in wages. I mean, what economic development program does that? So I think this bill is, I support it wholeheartedly. The Minnesota County Attorneys Association has had a discussion about this bill. We will take it up next meeting in our this coming month. But I know that having many conversations with my colleagues, they're very much wanting to be able to support this bill. And so I think there will be still some conversations, and we're working very closely with Representative Long and others who are interested in this passage. But I urge you to support this bill, because it will improve the quality of justice in our state, and I will also tell you that I believe that it will improve public safety, because if people can get on with their lives, get connected to their employment, to housing, all of those things that we all need, we are going to have a much healthier and safer community in the state of Minnesota. So thank you very much.
Thank you, County Commissioner Choi. And are you able to stick around for a little bit?
I can, yeah.
Okay. Because what I want to do, I know Chair Constantine has a question, but I want to get your other testifiers before us quickly, and then open up for questions and answers. So
thanks, Mr. Chair. Maybe I'll just bring up I have three remaining testifiers: Josh Esme with the Legal Rights Center, Brian Fullman with Isaiah, and Justin Terrell with the Council of Minnesotans of African Heritage.
Yeah, please come forward. In fact, if you could all come forward right away, then we can save a little bit of time moving people around. And who's going to go first? Mr. Esme?
I'd be happy to go first.
Wonderful. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Esme.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. So my name is Josh Esme. I'm an attorney at the Legal Rights Center, which is a nonprofit defense firm that represents individuals charged with juvenile and adult offenses in Hennepin County based on community need. We're sort of a little cousin to the public defender system. But what I wanted to share with you folks a little bit, kind of by way of advocating for this bill, is some of my experience volunteering at a monthly clinic that we call Second Chance Saturday, which I started volunteering at back in 2012 and have done basically one Saturday a month every month since then. And at Second Chance Saturday, we provide free legal advice and services to people who have questions about their criminal background studies and who have felt firsthand the impact of the collateral consequences that Mr. Choi and Representative Long were discussing. It has grown tremendously since 2012. In fact, this last month, we had our biggest turnout. We had 24 clients come, and they were helped by myself and one other attorney and about half a dozen law students. And that's the biggest number that we've ever had, and we've been, you know, getting bigger and bigger numbers of turnout sort of every month the last couple of years. And I think that really shows how much of a kind of unmet need there is in the legal community for this type of service and what type of, you know, incredible benefit the automatic expungement would have. You know, the expungements are not something that the public defenders can do. I know my colleagues in that office try, and they do, you know, sometimes they're able to do it, but by and large, systematically, they're not able to help their clients with the expungements. Legal aid doesn't do it because it is sort of a criminal law issue. And, you know, private attorneys can do it, but, you know, if you're somebody who can't find a job because of your criminal record, your ability to pay thousands of dollars for a private attorney is really limited. Just by way of example, a few of the people who came in at just this last month's Second Chance Saturday, we had a 19-year-old girl who had one thing on her offense. It was a single misdemeanor shoplifting case. She had lost her job in retail because of that. She was despairing because she and her mother were talking about needing her to drop out of college because they simply couldn't pay for it when she wasn't working her way through school. So we were able to help her get the petition. And that's one that, you know, 9 out of 10 times, maybe more, in my experience, is going to be granted when it gets in front of the judge. But there's, you know, the kind of the administrative barrier of finding an attorney to help do that. We had another woman, age 30, who was currently in nursing school, who was panicking because she had just been denied a certified nursing assistant job based on a case that went through diversion back in 2007. I had another guy, a 40-year-old guy, who had a fifth-degree assault back from 03 and a driving after cancellation, and he had lost his job as a bus driver and had been out of work and was about to lose his apartment. And so those are just a few of the people who came in, again, just this last month that I think illustrate the huge positive impact that this bill would have.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. I have an old history with legal rights that are going back to the, oh my gosh, I think it was the 80s. And so just a terrific resource available in our community. And so I appreciate the work with the Second Chance?
Second Chance Saturday, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for sharing those important stories. Mr. Terrell, I believe, are you next?
Yeah, I'm happy to go next, Mr. Chair.
Yeah,
brother.
I think you're a good closer, Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. Committee members, Representative Long, thank you for authoring this bill. And thank you to the community for folks for showing up for this discussion. Mr. Chair, I just want to continue to say that you guys have done a great job with theming these presentations. I think redemption is a great discussion that we should have today. My name is Justin Terrell. I'm the Executive Director of the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage. I'm sitting here to ask you to support the Clean Slate Bill, the language that would create for automatic expungements in the case of felonies for after 10 years. I think this is just a common sense reform. The Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage, we are advisors to the governor and the legislature on issues that impact our constituency. We represent every black African immigrant, African refugee person in the state of Minnesota. And we have some real issues in Minnesota that we got to deal with. And I think that rather than going over the particulars of the bill, I just want to take this opportunity to say that it's not just people with criminal records that need redemption in the state of Minnesota. It's the members of this committee. It's the folks who work for the state. Our state government has created racial disparities in our state. We are responsible for these. And the only way that we can address them is by, one, naming that it is our responsibility and creating some sort of dedication to do so. So I want to just point out, yesterday the OLA report encouraged an apology for the conditions, the work conditions in one of our prisons. And I think that's appropriate. We want folks to feel safe. We want folks to feel like they can go to work and do what they're here to do. We have not done that for Minnesotans of African heritage. We have not provided a proclamation or a determination to say that we will fix this problem. You want to talk about redemption, open our own law books and look through the pages at how we created the racial disparities in our state. Something simple like the Clean Slate Act gives us an opportunity to have this conversation, to say that when folks of African heritage return to community after being incarcerated or being impacted by the justice system, they're still at risk to facing, they were at risk to facing barriers to housing, education, employment. Those risks were there before the criminal justice system got involved. Upon returning, we need to create many roads for folks to travel to be able to have access to reduce those barriers. And if we don't, what are we actually doing? Are we really endorsing a criminal justice system that punishes people for life? If you haven't read Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson, you know, I just want to encourage you to flip through the pages. And the thing that I'm always shocked by in that book, not any like particular quotes, but I'm just shocked by how willing we are to use our criminal justice system to punish people unjustly. And that may have been in the late 80s, early 90s, but today we are still having issues with conviction integrity. We are still having issues with how we use our criminal justice system. So I ask you to support a policy like this, which is common sense. I've sat at many Second Chance Saturdays in North Minneapolis with a lot of my constituents seeking relief from their criminal record. Not because they're trying to get away with their from responsibility, but because they've accepted their responsibility and don't want to go back to any of the types of behavior that, frankly, lifelong punishment encourages. So I just want to say I hope that we take this opportunity and we look at opportunities like this to consider redemption for ourselves as state officials. And I am interested in just making sure that we have bipartisan support for bills like this and others. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Terrell. I do concur. We are all of us here inheritors and carriers of a legacy of racial injustice that's created horrible disparities. And the only question before us is, will we be actors to reverse and to redeem ourselves in our society? So I appreciate your call and take it strongly to heart. My hope is that this committee will work accordingly within the jurisdiction, incredible jurisdiction that it has. I also want to acknowledge this week the beautiful and powerful gathering at the State Rotunda that the council hosted. I was able to stop in briefly and chat with several members of the community. It's refreshing and powerful to see our African immigrant, African Americans, and Black Minnesotans gather powerfully in claiming their government for themselves. So thank you for your work.
Thank you, Madam. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Fulman.
Yes, yes.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all for having me. Just first and foremost, when I learned the Clean Slate Bill, I was just overjoyed, just like super excited about just having this conversation first. And then for it to be a real possibility that it can be something that we actually live by, that we hold ourselves accountable to. It's just energizing. So my name is Brian Fulman. I'm a lead organizer for Isaiah. It's a nonprofit organization that fights for the equity of all people across the state of Minnesota. My deliverable, my responsibility in that vehicle is to make sure that both African and African-American communities statewide understand that they have the right to step into the political arena, exercise their power, and then unify collectively to understand what that power does for the community. And there's a list of other things that we do inside of that as well. My job when I come here is not so much to get into the weeds of the policies and the technical steps that needs to be taken. We have brilliant comrades and colleagues who can handle that. What my responsibility is to do is to humanize these issues, to bring forth somebody who has been one of the people that you're talking about. So me, myself, I'm a felon. I don't like to say former because in a lot of ways I still get treated as one. So I'm a felon, even though my last felony came when I was 19 years old. And I have lived every day as a felon. It doesn't matter that I owned barbershops in the state of Minnesota. It doesn't matter that I got a 20-year history of working. It doesn't even matter I haven't been in trouble since then. It doesn't even matter that I got married here, that I'm a homeowner here, that I raised my kids here. It doesn't even matter for the last 7 years I have totally sacrificed my life for the betterment of my community. All that matters when it's time for me to apply or help my daughter or my son get an apartment is that my record still shows that I'm a threat to society. All that matters is as I excel and want to improve my life and be more of a model for the community that I invest in on a day-to-day basis, that my record shows that I'm still a felon. So this is a no-brainer for me. And please excuse my bias, but I won't apologize for it. What this does is it stops the hypocrisy in the state of Minnesota. If we're saying that people are included once they're done serving whatever time that they need to serve, once they've been cleared, it strips us publicly of what we can do and it limits our access to be great. There are a lot of my brothers and sisters, you have to understand something. The night before last, I put 100 plus black folks in the caucus path. Those kind of numbers, people told me when I first started organizing that that couldn't happen. I'm not brilliant. I just invited them. I reminded them that they are included, that they can decide. But if you constantly have people with a record that indicates that they're not included, a record that indicates that they don't have access. And for a lot of us, it also indicates to us that we can't be great, that we really don't have a clean slate, that we'll continue to live out from mistakes that we've made years ago. I'm the first to invite anybody in this room to raise your hand if you haven't made a mistake that may be deemed illegal. The difference between a lot of us and a lot of you all is we got caught. How long do we live that out? How long do we wake up every day grounded in the fact that we're criminals? How long do we live out that when I look at a brother like this with a suit on that I can't be that? Or if I see my brother sitting up there right now, there's an explanation or a justification why I can't be that. It has a lot to do with how we message and we tell people who they are once they've actually left the system. I just got through talking to Minnesota sentencing guidelines around the fact of 5-year probation cap. These are the kind of implications when we talk about how the system operates. How can you have good self-esteem and self-confidence where everywhere you turn, you're a felon? You're not worthy of being a part of our democracy. You're not worthy of being in the same lane that I am. But you expect these people to act as though they're part of our civil makeup. You expect these people to actually operate like you would or like I would. But yet again, know your place. Sit over there. You're a felon. I ask all of us for a second from your day to stop weighing the pros and cons about what power can be made, what political move do I need to make. Put down the strategy for 1 minute and just ask yourself about the nature of human beings and how we respond when we all included versus how we respond when we categorized. It's not a good feeling. It's been a lot of work that I've had to do to redeem myself. There's a lot of things I had to ignore because this democracy and this law did not speak to the betterment of my life. But everybody doesn't have that access. Everybody doesn't have those resources. I was blessed to run into Isaiah. Because they was actually, my power organization was the first organization to say, you know what, you have the right, you were included. How can we say it to a lot of people who did not have the resource that I had? I think this bill speaks to that. I think this bill speaks to the state of Minnesota being intentional around inclusion. Point blank. We have gifted minds, but we're not unlocking them because we're too busy isolating them. So I ask you all today to think about that aspect of human life. I could go on and on talking to you about the isolation and the disparity and how it causes people to walk around with their heads down, but I won't. I'll challenge you to think about somebody in your own family that you love dearly. I challenge you to make sure every time you have Thanksgiving dinner, you sit them at the red table because they're not worthy of it, because they made a mistake in the past. I challenge all of you all today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fullman. Your passion is well received in a committee that will often have exchanges with one another with a high level of passion as we pursue a higher vision for social justice. I could tell you, just me personally, my family is a brown, black, white, Asian immigrant family. We're incredibly diverse. One of our beloveds is a 41-year-old African-American who I love. He's still paying the price 20 years after having done things he shouldn't have done. They weren't violent acts, although it doesn't matter. It's 20 years later. His ability to support his immediate family, which is my part of my family, is incredibly compromised as a result of that. He struggles every day to be able to find that dignity, be validated, just simply in trying to obtain a job that can support him and his family. He's paid the price. He's a good man. He's a good citizen. And so I wholeheartedly and from my spirit concur with your comments here today. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Representative Long, I believe we'll open up for questions. Oh, please don't go too far because there may be questions for some of you. Do you have any other testifiers, Representative Long? I'm sorry. Any other testifiers at this point?
No.
Okay, very well. We do have a question for Representative Considine. Chair Considine.
I think you're the one I need.
County Attorney Choi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Long or Attorney Chow.
Choi,
I'm sorry. The de facto policy of the state for the first 120, 130 years was automatic expungement. There was no records kept. I mean, you just didn't have it. That didn't carry over. I'm kind of wondering about the timeline. When did this actually start where we carried this on for an extended period? And I'm right on that, right? First 120, 30 years, particularly misdemeanors, gross misdemeanors, there was no record system. So I'm kind of wondering when this switched.
County Attorney Charles, go for it. Or Mr. Resby.
So I guess I'll address that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sorry.
I think you're exactly right, and it was a function of the technology, right? And so for most of that period of time, the records that we were talking about were physical paper records that were held at the courthouse. And the state law has retention schedules for how long the court had to keep those records, and then as a matter of necessity, they were tossed out, so that the storage room could be filled with next year's records. In addition to that, the paper records were a lot harder to come by, too. So, you could, if you wanted to find out if someone had a record, you had to go to the Hennepin County Courthouse and then the Ramsey County Courthouse and then the Washington County Courthouse. All that started to change, basically early 90s with the development of the electronic record system and the Minnesota Court Information System, and then really started to explode in the early 2000s with easy internet access for these background checks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's first 130, 140 years that was the de facto policy. 19, huh? I'm just trying to think. I was in college when I was 19, and I'm trying to remember if I may have made a mistake or two. I'm pretty sure I did, but I could also tell you I don't believe there's actually any record of it anywhere that you could find. So doesn't really seem fair. Thank you.
Thank you. There's a question from Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, and I can't remember the testifier's name was on the end. I understand where you're coming from. One of the issues that we deal with and why their records are kept, Minnesota and this whole country has become a very logistic or lawsuit-happy state. You go to get housing, you have to fill out the form, and they do a background check. And unfortunately, something might have happened 20 years ago, but if something happens to an individual that it might even be an accident, the landlords and the owners of those apartment buildings are going to get sued by something you did as an accident. We need major tort reform before any of this is going to get better. And so, like I say, I know where you're coming from. A good friend of mine, Gene, this goes back to something else I'm going to talk about as well. Back in, I believe it was 93, they changed some laws where it lessened the number of regulations that prevented somebody from owning a firearm for life. They removed some of the lifetime restrictions. But if you're born on July 31st of that year, you still had to live under those old restrictions. If you were born August 1st, you had the new restrictions, so that didn't matter. You happened to be born towards the end of July. He was 18 years old, and his buddies decided to take a motorcycle sitting out in front of a yard for a joyride, and he got on for the ride. He got caught. He got charged. His buddy was 17. He was 18. He got charged for the theft of the motor vehicle, a lifetime restriction on owning firearms because he was 18 years old. If his birthday would have been a couple weeks later, it wouldn't be an issue. A couple years ago, we passed laws to allow a look back because he had his firearms permit to carry. He's been a law-abiding citizen ever since. But we did that look back, and now he's banned from owning firearms, which is wrong. That's something I want to try to work on. So there are some things that I understand what's going on with this thing. With the automatic expungement, but there's some things in here I have problems with allowing the automatic expungement. One of them is one of the bill I had on wildfire arson. Wildfire arson, a person is setting many fires before they finally get caught. They cause hundreds of thousands of dollars. In fact, we had some United States citizens killed down in Australia.
Representative Johnson, I apologize for interrupting my colleague, but if you can get to a question, because we still have questioners.
I will get to the question. Well.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Down in Australia, they had a bunch of wildfires, and we had a plane carrying U.S. military personnel trying to put that fire out. Those fires out. They were killed. And most of those fires are down there in Australia. What we're hearing over the news, once they found out they were set by arsonists, we didn't hear about them anymore. They didn't fit a certain narrative. But some of the issues I have in here, discharging of a firearm, automatic expungement, I think we need some of the things. There's about half of them I have a problem with. Like I was saying with the wildfires, a person sets many fires before they get caught. They might get caught for one, and they could set many more and never get caught again. So I think we need to do some of this stuff, but we need to do it properly and take a real good look at it. Because our system, unfortunately, loves lawsuits, And until we get lawsuit reform, a lot of this stuff isn't going to change.
Hold on just one second. I want to go to the author first, Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Johnson, for the questions. I think one of the benefits of this bill from the litigiousness standpoint is that for employers and for folks who are providing housing, if there's no record that they have to check, then there is no opportunity for a lawsuit. There's nobody can sue them for renting to somebody or hiring somebody. So this has had really broad support from employers in other states where it's been passed, and we're starting to have great conversations with employers in this state about this bill as well. So I think that's a big help of the bill. With regard to the crimes that are in here, this was the agreement under the current law for eligibility for expungement, the list of felonies you mentioned. Certainly, if there are ones that you, like wildfire arson, if that's one that's of particular concern to you and you would be willing to support the bill if we remove that, I'd be happy to work with you on that.
So Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Long. The tough part, and we've discussed this in civil law many times, even when we did this original bill. I think Chair Lesh at the time. The biggest issue that we have is once the information is public, we can seal it in the courts, but with the internet today, it's always going to be there, no matter what. You're going to find it. News. Just Google a name, and the report will show up.
That's a good point, Representative Long.
Mr. Chair, to that point, you're right. There's going to be ways to find this, but responsible employers are not going to Google. They're going to do a background check and look for whether there's a record. And if there's not a record, then they'll hire the people, and same with responsible landlords. So this is going to allow for, open up many more opportunities for hiring and for housing, and we've seen that in other states.
Could I expand on that just for a moment?
Please.
So in my experience, talking to folks at Second Chance Saturday who have been denied jobs, more often than not, they'll come with a background check that they get from the employer, and that's actually required under federal law under the Fair Credit Reporting Act that applies to all employers that are using basically third-party background check vendors to conduct these background studies for them, which is the prevailing practice. And one of the requirements under the Fair Credit Reporting Act is that these companies that provide the background studies to the employers have to maintain both accurate and verifiable databases. So when the record is removed from the state database, whether it's MNSIS or the BCA, via expungement, then those companies need to update their record too to make sure that it is still accurate and still verifiable. So even if there is sometimes a legacy of the record on the internet, which does happen, but more often than not, it really doesn't, at least in my experience. But even when it does happen, with the employers in particular, they're still going through sort of a regimented background check process. And they do that in part because they could be liable under federal civil rights law if they don't. So, yeah, as well as the Fair Credit Reporting Act.
Mr. Fullman, you did want to jump in, so I want to make sure you have an opportunity as well.
So what was already explained by Representative Jamie Lovett, just exactly what I was going to say, but just even further than that, just more of a bigger picture, just to have like some like common sense around what we're talking about. It's just amazing how sometimes we take, we take a stand on what might not be perfect about a bill. I just have not witnessed any law in this country that served everybody perfectly with perfect timing, you know. Whatever system we have now in place, if you want to talk about what's effective or who deserves to be this needs, how would this actually implicate certain communities or certain people? Or maybe there may be some loopholes, or it may be some people who take advantage of what we're trying to do here as far as implement an automatic expungement. There are some people who won't be worthy of this. I mean, let's just say that. That's just the truth. The question we need to ask ourselves as human beings is how many people would actually benefit from it? There is no perfect anything. I know that because when I was in jail, I was by plenty of people who didn't deserve to be there at the time. And a lot of you all know innocent people who are in jail right now. Do we abandon our system because of that?
So I think sometimes when we're trying to make a point or we have a concern about a bill, I think we always need to start off with how many people would be affected by this bill in a good way? How many people would actually have a new light come on in their eyes about what's possible for them because of this? Versus a few people who are not worthy of it. I just don't, as human beings, it would be very complicated for us to design anything that specifically speaks to just the people who deserve it and not other people who don't. So I just thought that for me, it's just kind of ridiculous, to be honest with you. I just want us to stand on this and then I'm gone. When you talk about people who get in apartments, I'll just use this as an example. The first thing I thought about when he said, well, what if you want to get an apartment? I'm thinking to myself, well, $50, $70 for application fee. What if this? I just think of every step somebody has to take that's in my shoes just to get an apartment. The last thing they worried about is, oh, if I make a mistake, I'm going to get sued for this and sued for that. Just like I teach my base all the time, nothing is perfect before you take a public risk. Anytime you take a public risk and say, this is the right thing to do, there's going to be some things that may not end up the way we want them to. Number two, you have to create a mandate to affect the tone of what's going on in your state. The reason why department people are suing because or holding people liable who may have a record, you have to explain that to me. I still don't get it. But if we start setting a tone and reshaping the political environment in this state, then people will respond to what the law is. But we have to take a public risk to be able to do that. That means everything won't be perfect on paper before we take a step. Be grounded in the fact that you know somebody who's worthy of this. That's all I got.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Foreman.
Yeah, thank you.
We have questions from Representative Dean, Chair Dean, and then followed by Novotny. Chair Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Long, and all the testifiers. We seem to meet in many places, which I think is a good thing. My question is about the automatic expungement, and Mr. Esme, you brought up the issue of, you know, are these individuals that keep records are supposed to purge them, supposed to update them, and supposed to do all that. And we know that doesn't always happen. For many years, we've talked about issues putting in statute penalties if they don't. So an individual, if somehow they are harmed or unable to get a place to live or unable to get a job because a particular provider of background checks is not updating the information, that they'd have some civil recourse. And I think that that's something that maybe it's time to move beyond talking about that here and actually starting to put a bill together. You know, I'm really curious about this issue of expungement of arrests because we know that there are some media folks that comb through arrest records. And, of course, once the media gets a hold of that, that then creates a record within the media beyond the individual, background check companies that keep this information. So I think we need to begin to expand actually what we're thinking about, too, when we think about holding those often known as data harvesters, liable for what they do. I think we need to start thinking about media, and that media probably has some responsibility after time. I think this is a great bill. The idea of actually making this, automatic makes a lot of sense. The process of hiring an attorney and all those other things begins to add up for an individual's. And if you're not well-versed in the legal system, it's pretty easy to make a mistake. This falls short of some of the issues around being pardoned, which we know that there's work being done on that relative to that. So, have you thought about, crafting a bill that would be connected or related to this bill that actually holds those background check companies actually liable for individuals who may be harmed? I guess if there's a question there, that's what it would be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Dean. I think that's a good issue to raise, and it's not one I'm steeped in and would love to work with you more on it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Representative Novotny, and then I would like to have us move on this bill so we can get to the other bills as well. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Representative Long, would this address jobs that are sensitive, like police officers or people that work in nursing homes and have access to drug disbursements and things like that.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So currently our expungement, this would not change the nature of an expungement. And right now, under our current state law, expunged records, law enforcement still has access to those. And so does Department of Human Services. Did you want to speak to that?
I think we dialed a friend, perhaps.
So does Department of Human Services. So if there was an eligibility question for a job in those areas, that this would not change.
Thank you.
And Representative Long, again, I think as you presented the bill, and I think County Attorney Choi spoke to this as well, this isn't expungement for everything that's out there. We're talking about acts that this legislature at some point had already decided were eligible for expungement. Is that correct?
And that's right, Mr. Chair.
How does that relate perhaps to the question?
Misdemeanors and certain enumerated felonies that the legislature had already decided in 2015 were eligible. And I think Mr. Spader wanted to chime in as well.
Good to see you, Mr. Saavedra.
Good afternoon, Representative Mariani. I'm Jorge Saavedra. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I've been working on expungements in large part over the last year. And the question regarding, and I think Representative Long answered it substantially, but I just wanted to add that there are some specific exclusions, in particular for crimes that require any sort of registration. And when we're talking about specifically about drug crimes, this is largely applicable to the lowest level drug crimes. There is still an exclusion there. Under certain circumstances, also, an expunged record is a sealed record. It's not an erased record. And so for certain purposes, in particular things like employment qualification, occupational licensing, in certain sensitive areas, the state and other government entities can look through that seal and still examine the criminal record that has been expunged. So I believe that would be applicable, for example, in the case of law enforcement occupational licensing. To license a police officer, the state has broad discretion to examine the criminal record of an individual even after the record has been expunged.
Thank you. Thank you for the question, Representative Adani. Very well. Is there anyone else that wishes to comment on the bill? If not, then Representative Long renews his motion that House File 3816 be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Long. Thank you all for your testimony. County Attorney Choi, I look forward to hearing what the conversation yields over at the MCA's gathering in a week or so. Thank you for being with us here today. With that, members, actually, Representative Long, don't go far. We have House File 2806. And Representative Long moves that House File 2806 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And there is an author's amendment, the A20-0633-DE amendment. Is it your desire to move that?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Representative Long moves adoption of the DE amendment, puts the bill in the shape in which he wishes it to be before us today. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. The House File 2806 as amended is before us. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're talking about second chances today. We're talking about the need for forgiveness and for compassion. And a pardon is perhaps the embodiment of these values. It allows someone to start entirely anew with the knowledge that they have made amends for their past crimes. Our current process, though, leaves much to be desired. It suffers from a lack of transparency, from a bottleneck in the review process, and from constitutional defects. And this bill hopes to address those three issues. First, on the transparency problem, right now a petitioner files a pardon application with the Commissioner of Corrections. There is an initial review, then an investigation process, and the department determines if the application satisfies eligibility requirements and forwards the application to the board. This process is opaque with no real public accountability or criteria for review by the department. Second, there is a bottleneck problem. The hearings are conducted by the pardon board of the governor, the attorney general, and the chief justice. These are three of the busiest people that we have in the entire state. Hearings are conducted only twice a year with 15 to 30 cases in each session. And having to conduct the hearings themselves greatly limits the time for review. And as a result, Minnesota is on the low end nationwide in terms of both petitions reviewed and petitions granted, about one-third of all pardons extraordinary. The third problem that this bill attempts to address is a constitutional one. The state constitution says pardon decisions must be made by the governor, quote, in conjunction with the Board of Pardons, yet our current process requires unanimity, which is inconsistent with this language. The bill fixes these problems in two ways. One, it establishes a clemency review commission. This is based on the successful South Dakota model. The commission would be nine people, three each, appointed by the governor, attorney general, and chief justice. At least four times each year, the commission would review applications for pardons or commutations. The bill sets out criteria the commission must consider in this review, including demonstrated rehabilitation, the seriousness of the crime, acceptance of responsibility, remorse, and restitution to victims. The commission will vote on recommendations to send to the pardon board. And this would solve the transparency problem because the decision making about moving to the next step would be in the open and with specified criteria. It would also solve the bottleneck problem by adding capacity. The bill would maintain victim notification provisions, and the commission also has less risk of re-traumatizing victims because instead of a big public show in front of three of the most high-profile people in the state, you are going to be in a less visible context with a commission. And finally, with the constitutional concerns, the bill would require a majority vote with the governor in the majority, and this is as close as you can get to a literal reading of the meaning of Article 5, Section 7, the governor in conjunction with the Board of Pardons. So this is a common sense approach that would help correct the challenges with the current system in a fair, transparent way. I have four testifiers. First would be Commissioner Paul Schnell.
Very well. Actually, if all your testifiers could come forward so we can maximize our time. It would be terrific. And then we have our Commissioner of Corrections, Commissioner Schnell. You can be our first testifier.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good to see you again. My name is Paul Schnell. I'm the Commissioner of Corrections, and I also have the privilege of serving as the Secretary to the Board of Pardons at present. I will leave a lot of the details to Professor Osler and others to explain the details of the bill. But I'm here to share with you that we believe this issue around reforming the pardon process is of great importance to both our state and certainly to the governor. We are here supporting this body and the legislature giving serious consideration to the proposal in front of you and consideration also of the great benefits and impact it can have on Minnesotans. As we believe that we want the pardon process to be something that is accessible, and right now it's quite overwhelming. I have asked our staff, who currently process on behalf of the board applications, to do everything we can to make that easier, but we do believe that considerable work needs to be done. During my testimony yesterday, and in keeping with some of the earlier testimony around the expungement process, I mentioned yesterday that most organized religions do encourage believers to provide the opportunity for redemption to those who have at one time engaged in wrongdoing and taking actions to do everything they can to make whole the harm that was caused. Pardons are, in fact, critical to that. And while I may not have personal experience, some may ask, why is it so important that someone who has demonstrated that they've been rehabilitated and living successfully in the community, what difference does it make if they receive a pardon or not? I can't tell you personally what that would be like, and others will. But I can tell you, I have been profoundly moved by the response to those who have been granted a pardon. The sense of relief, the sense of true redemption, and the opportunity to become whole again is what I've heard from them. And I think as we think about criminal justice and we think about what our business is, and that is ultimately to have people be much more strongly connected, pardons provide a mechanism for that to happen. And so I'm grateful to be here today on behalf of the governor to offer support for strong and thoughtful consideration of the proposal in front of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. And who's next? Dr. Osler, looks like you've been tapped to be next. Welcome to our committee.
I'm fine with that. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Osler. I am a former federal prosecutor. I currently serve as the Robert and Marion Short Professor of Law at the University of St. Thomas Law School. And I also hold the Ruthie Maddox Chair in Preaching. As a scholar, for about the last decade, I've studied clemency. And a lot of my work has been at the national level. Through the Obama administration and into the Trump administration, I've worked with a coalition on the right and the left, a group that includes the Heritage Foundation, the Koch Foundation, at the national level, trying to reinvigorate the clemency process there. And several years ago, one of my collaborators in that effort in D.C. turned to me and said, "What about Minnesota? What happens there?" And to my chagrin, I realized I didn't really know. So when I got back, I looked up when the next pardon board hearing was, and I went to go watch. And what I saw was really stunning. There in front of the governor, the attorney general, the chief justice of the Supreme Court, was a man, a grandfather, whose conviction was long ago, who wanted to go hunting with his grandson. But to make that case, he had to go and personally plead his case without a lawyer to that group. And after that, I started to go to more and more of the pardon board hearings. I think I've been to four of the last five. And what I've seen is an inefficient, unproductive process. We are put to shame by the productivity and the efficiency of many other states, in fact, nearly all of them. When my fellow scholars analyze state systems, the states that come out at the top, frankly, are states like South Carolina, Arkansas, Georgia. And I have a clinic at St. Thomas. I teach criminal law, but I also have a clinic where we do federal commutations. But we started to look at the state system as well. And once we did, we started to reach out to people in other states who dealt with clemency in their states. When we talked to people from South Dakota, we found something that would be a pretty good model for what we can do here that would be different. Representative Long, I think, did a fine job of describing what the problems are with the current system. But let's talk about the solution, which is embodied in the bill that's before. One of the things, the primary things that this does, is it creates a commission underneath the board that is going to actually have the hearings. And that does a couple things that are significant. One is it ratchets the pressure down on people who want clemency and on victims who may want to testify. As a prosecutor, I was trained that in everything that you do, you have to keep in mind what the role of victims is in process and allow them that role. But when you're telling a victim that if you want to appear in person, you're going to have to step up in front of the governor of the state, and then they're going to talk about your testimony in front of you, that's pretty intimidating. And so this commission would be able to have those hearings. And in what would be a less formal process. Now, the members of that commission, and again, this is based on the way they do it in South Dakota, would be appointed in equal part by the governor, the attorney general, and the chief justice. They'd each pick three members. As they conducted those hearings, records would be kept. The bill requires that one of the things that the commission does is reach out to the prosecuting attorney and to the judge and to the victim and solicit their views on each case. And those are things that will be passed along with the rest of the file to the board once they make the recommendation. So the commission now would take over what the Department of Corrections does, which is the intake, would hold the hearings, and then make a recommendation by majority vote to the board. When you get to the level of the board, it would the process would be different in that instead of a majority vote, it would be, by a unanimous vote, it would be by a majority with governor in that majority. Representative Long mentioned the unconstitutionality of the current system, and you know, as a law professor, one of the first things I did when I started looking at this was write myself a brief about the constitutionality of that. But that phrase that's used in the Constitution in conjunction with does not mean that the others get a veto, and we see that elsewhere in the law. If we're going to allow a veto by another part of the government, we call that advising consent. There is a phrase, and that is used in the Constitution. In other parts of Minnesota law, we see this phrase used in conjunction with. For example, in section 253D.30, the executive director of the state's sex offender program is charged with creating a discharge plan for a civilly committed sex offender in conjunction with the offender. Now, that means that the offender has to be consulted, but it doesn't mean that the offender gets a veto over the plan. This really flies in the face of the plain meaning of the Constitution and the way it's used elsewhere in the law. The one thing, too, that is embedded in this piece of legislation is that right now we have commutations which shorten a sentence, which haven't been used in the past few decades, and pardons and pardon extraordinary. Now, the pardon extraordinary should probably be called the pardon ordinary, because it's something that has limitations that a regular pardon doesn't. But it's also fairly confusing. And instead of having two categories of pardon, this just creates pardons without the window dressing of pardon extraordinary as a part of it. This is a restructure. It's about process. But when we look at the productive, efficient systems across the states, what we see making a difference isn't politics, it's process. And those states that have a process using a commission like this one that's advisory are pretty much across the board those that are most productive, most efficient. It's a restructure, but at its heart there's something pretty important, and that is that clemency, as it was put into the United States Constitution, was contrary to almost everything else that was put in, which was limiting the powers of kings. And then they put in the middle of it the power of a king. And that's because it's the part of the Constitution and a part of our state constitution that's the soul of it. It's something that reaches into our deepest principles and values, and that is forgiveness and a recognition that people can change. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Oslin.
Thank you for your time. I know this is a very busy season for everybody here. My name is Seth Evans. I serve as the chaplain at the Ramsey County Jail. I also oversee a ministry called Metro Hope Ministries, which is a Christian treatment program for men, women with their children. Have just recently, in the last session, been granted a pardon extraordinary. That was for several drug convictions. When I was younger, I went to school, I became a paramedic. I worked in the medical field, moved to Minnesota, began to work in that field, or to further my education in that. I got caught for marijuana possession and was convicted of a felony.
I was no longer allowed to work inside that field. I was young at the time. I didn't know that I could do anything about it. It was unemployable as far as I knew. My addiction grew, progressed, got into more and more drugs. In 2003, I was convicted of a couple other drug crimes, and I have to say this, is that I thank God for the intervention of law enforcement and the judicial system. They saved my life. It was the end of my addiction at that point. The courts and law enforcement saved my life. That was it. I haven't touched drugs in almost 20 years. You know, since that time, I've done everything that I could to demonstrate that change and help everyone that I could come out of that lifestyle. Since my last conviction, it's been 17 years. It took 17 years for me to be able to even apply for a pardon. To work in the field that I am, every 2 years I have to go through DHS set-aside and explain all of my convictions and why it's different now. So I've spent the last 17 years, every 2 years, explaining to the DHS why I'm no longer a threat to somebody else. And then to work inside corrections, I have to do it almost every year. So I have to take about 2 years every year, or 2 weeks every year, to sit down and go through these two huge boxes of files. And I have to relive the crimes that I committed. I have to go back and look at the person that I was. It's a person I don't recognize. I have to go through that emotional stress all the time. Thank God there is a system where I can be pardoned. You know, I know that God has forgiven me for the things that I've done, but I feel as though finally the state of Minnesota has finally forgiven me. And I don't have to keep going back into those boxes and look at that person. There are other people that recovery is working for. There is a lot of people that have made mistakes and have learned from those mistakes. Not everyone is as well equipped as I am to be able to get to that point and work through that. I know when I was younger, I wasn't able to. I'm a person, I work with a lot of people. I see people that are serious about change and people that aren't serious about change. And one thing that you notice with people that are serious about change is that they set goals and they work hard to achieve them. When you look at what it takes to get a pardon, for most people coming out of that lifestyle, that's an unachievable goal. To wait as long as they did, to be able to fill out the paperwork, to be able to go everywhere that they have to go to get that, it's almost impossible. It makes them want to give up. Today, I feel like a different person. I'm not different than I was 2 weeks ago before I got my actual pardon in the mail. But I feel like a different person. I'm prouder. Prouder of the achievements that I've made. And I hope to be a light to a lot of people. You can do this too. You can do this too. But it's going to take me 17 years, 20 years. Some people won't even be off probation. Recovery works. Help. I just ask for your consideration. To think about helping people, give them something that's attainable, a goal that they can achieve. Don't keep it out of their reach.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. We are humbled by your words. We celebrate your sobriety, and we welcome your pardon as part of your journey to redemption. It's a powerful force in the spirit. It's our intent to make it a powerful force centered in our laws as well. So thank you for being that light here today, Mr. Evans. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gina Evans, and I know quite a few of you at the table. And the first thing I want to say is today, I'm just here as citizen Gina Evans, constituent Gina Evans. I'm not here representing any of the organizations that I'm with. I'm just here as a citizen. And that's really important today, because in 2016, I went through all the work that it was to get my pardon. And I brought my pardon with me today, and it was a lot of work. It took me 3 months to do this, and if you guys want to be pretty open about it, if you want to look at it, you're welcome to. I have 15 criminal convictions. My highest level of conviction was a level 3 for theft of a motor vehicle. I had a 15-year IV meth addiction. 4 of those charges are low-level drug convictions. My 4 drug convictions, I got caught all together with 4/10 of a gram of drugs. 2 of them were trace amounts. They're check forgeries. I was talking to Representative, I was talking to Cynthia in the hallway. I was a pest. Like, I was a nuisance. I don't know that I was dangerous, but I was definitely a pest in the community. But I had a drug addiction, a pretty serious one, and it caused I committed a lot of crimes because of it, to get drugs and to feed my addiction. And because of that, I committed a lot of crimes to get those drugs. And so that's why my pardon application is as long as it is. And the application took a long time. I had to make a lot of phone calls. There were some of those convictions that were so long ago, from 1997, that the cities that the crimes were committed in didn't have the records anymore. And so I had to make phone calls back and forth with the DOC and with the city attorney's office, and then finally got an email from them that said that they no longer had those records, and then had to get clearance with the DOC that was going to be enough. So it was all these phone calls back and forth and some driving that went into it. And for me, I got letters of character letters to go along with the application, and I was able to get them from sheriffs and legislators and pastors and some other people from the community. I think pretty good character letters. And when I walked out of my pardon hearing after receiving my pardon, and I was a blubbering mess, I've never been so nervous in my whole life as I was at that pardon hearing in front of those 3 people that held the rest of my future in their hands. And I don't get real nervous very easy. I'm pretty, talkative and bubbly. Somebody from the media, a reporter there, and he said, I've been covering these for 20 years, and I would have bet my mortgage, because of the length of your criminal history, that they were not going to give you a pardon. You're a pretty lucky girl. Thinking about, like, my length of criminal history, and, you know, I'm Seth and I aren't unique. There are a lot of people out there doing a lot of good work that come from backgrounds like ours that have turned their lives around, and they're out helping other people and working in recovery and working in the addiction field or working in advocacy and out doing the work trying to show other people that life can be different and, like, be different so other people can follow in our footsteps and, like, smooth the road to make it better for the people coming behind us. We're not exceptions. But I know that the reason that I was granted my pardon is because I am connected and I am educated and I do have privilege. And you guys have an opportunity now to make this pardon process better. to make it more less bureaucratic and more attainable for more people like us. Because there's a lot of us out there that are doing the work, and that I'm not any more deserving of the pardon that I received than anybody else. I just was more able and capable and connected to be able to get it. And so I'm just asking you guys to consider looking at this process in a way that makes it less bureaucratic and more possible for more people like us, because there are lots of us out there that are deserving of a pardon and ready for it and want to make a difference and deserve housing and deserve better jobs and deserve the pardon that we got. And you guys are in a position of power to make that happen for more of us. And so thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Evans. You and Seth are examples of the power of pardons, the power of redemption. Thank you for being with us today, but also more importantly, thank you for your presence in our society and in our world in the way that you are. Representative Long, you've given us examples, two individuals, of examples of when the power of what could be possible when there is a pardon. But as we heard from the very beginning, those are still fairly rare in this state and done in a way that's frankly arguably inefficient. And therefore the rareness of it. And so I take it that was part of, you know, why you laid these testifiers before us. Are there any questions, Representative Lucero?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, just a comment. I've met Gina in the past, and we've actually had multiple conversations in my office. And I haven't met the other testifier, the gentleman, before, but I just wanted to express I'm always encouraged when I hear testimony like what you've shared with what you've gone through, because as Gina and I have discussed several times, we serve a God of second chances. And that's incredibly important because we've all made mistakes, and when we've turned from that and we've used our lives to help others behind us, it certainly is very important. So, again, I'm always humbled when I hear the testimony of what the two of you have done and you continue to fight for. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. You capture my thoughts and emotions as well. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it seems that we're running out of time. So I'll try to wrap House File 40 into my comments and my questions. I think this is a really, really important thing to do. When I went through my pardon, it was three individuals, and I was scared as hell that day. For some reason, they asked me a question out of left field, which totally blew me away. And I was like, I have no idea why you're asking me that. And of course, you know, it had been several years since I'd committed my offense. I, you know, had become clean and sober, and it was just one of those things that, you know, at the time I walked out and I didn't know. It wasn't until you actually received the letter, which is a really weird place to be, that you presented and they hadn't made their decision and you don't know, and you have to wait. But it is a very, very difficult process, much more difficult today than it was when I got mine in 1982. The number of pardons these days are much, much less. And I think that some of the provisions that you have in here, Representative Long, will change that. You know, one thing that I think at some point we have to begin to think about when we're considering issues around clemency and pardon is the disparities in our criminal justice system. And I'm guessing the disparities continue to exist, even when it comes to granting pardons and things like that. And, you know, there's probably a myriad of reasons of how you can justify and rationalize why that happens, but that doesn't matter. Because for those individuals who are trying to reestablish their lives, there's an incredible obstacle to that process. Like many individuals, and this is getting to House File 40, I thought that once I was convicted of a felony, that I would lose my right to vote forever. And so I applied for a pardon. I applied for a pardon because I wanted my right to vote. I wanted to participate in society and have that say in who are those individuals that represent me, whether it's at the school board, whether it's at the park board, whether it's state legislature, or whether it's the President of the United States. And that is still a common belief around a lot of individuals who have been convicted of a felony. I knock on doors. I've heard stories of other people knock on doors that say, you know, I'd like you to come out and vote. You know, there's voting in 2-3 weeks, and they say, well, I can't. Why is that? Well, I'm a convicted felon. And then you go to the question, well, are you still under supervision or are you still on paper? They go, no, I've been off for 8 years, but I don't want a chance, you know, getting in trouble for going out and voting and getting put back in jail. You know, I've often said that we deem these individuals to be safe enough to be out in public. They should be safe enough at a voting booth. There are many individuals, and I'm glad to see the changes that are currently going through relative to length of probation, where individuals were able to, after their offense, were able to, you know, establish their lives, have families. Kids go all the way through high school, and they could never even vote to who was going to be on the school board. And that's just wrong. I mean, it's just wrong. And if we want people to be their best selves, we have to create those opportunities for not only for their redemption, but to actually have a little bit of benefit from their redemption. Because we know that when good things happen to people, when they're doing good, they'll continue to do more good. So I really appreciate this. I wish it was my bill, but that's okay. But that's okay. I can't carry every bill here. And I just appreciate you coming here, and I appreciate your stories. And I just hope that next time we have some people come and talk about receiving pardons and their redemption that unfortunately isn't those of us that have privilege because of this color of our skin, but it's actually other individuals in our state that are disproportionately impacted as well. So I don't know if there was really a question, but I think I present a little bit of reason why we should pass House File 40, and thank you guys for the opportunity.
Representative Dean, I appreciate your observations. I also appreciate the efficiency in which you helped me to manage this committee, because you laid out a pretty concise and powerful and good rationale behind House File 40. Our intent earlier today was to have a much longer conversation about that, but I think you cut right to the chase, and I greatly appreciate you putting that on the record for us today. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Representative Long, I see in the bill that apparently the Clemency Review Commission can hire staff. Have you requested a fiscal note yet?
Representative Long.
I can't. Maybe we can defer to fiscal staff.
Let's ask fiscal staff their thoughts on this. Mr. Walz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I have put in a request for a fiscal note. It doesn't specify where the money would go for the reimbursements, but I was assuming that corrections would staff this. I put in a request for MMB or corrections to talk to each other and find where the funding they thought would be appropriate to go to.
Thank you. Chair Mariani.
Representative Johnson.
A couple of things. We should have time, hopefully time, for the at least two more stops this bill needs to take. That fiscal note to come in. It also mentions Chapter 13, which is required to go to judiciary and civil law. And also, because there's rulemaking, it does need to go to government notch. I trust that this bill will be taking the proper path.
Representative Johnson, it certainly is our intention to make sure this and all our bills take the proper path. And I appreciate your counsel, and I will certainly be working with Representative Long to make sure that that is the case. Representative Johnson.
In judiciary this morning, we had a bill that should have came here. It had five new gross misdemeanor crimes and new definitions for statutes, but apparently went to the Dreadnought Register instead.
Representative Johnson, Chair Lesh and I had that conversation. This has popped up a few times in the last session, and certainly in this session we're you know, our committees, the commitment of the chairs of our committee is not to have redundant hearings. And so we make our best call relative to those overlap areas to make sure that those issues are covered efficiently in one committee and not have to re-litigate them in another committee. And that was one bill that we thought, fit that definition. Representative Johnson.
I will keep that in mind. I'll let Republican lead of judiciary also be aware of that. So when we have public safety issues, we can deal with them in judiciary. And when we have judiciary issues for the bills that are not going there, we can deal with judiciary's issues in public safety instead of trying to keep them separate.
And, Representative Johnson, that's a good reminder. In fact, we have had that conversation openly in both committees in the last session. I will certainly encourage our colleague, the chair of that committee, to have that conversation. And I will strive to do the same with you. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll renew my motion.
Very well. So, members, the... Yeah, that's probably makes sense. Yeah. Representative Long, are you adverse to amending this motion for it to move over to judiciary so we can double make sure? It would also be wonderful to have more ownership on both sides of the aisle in that committee, the members who haven't heard it here. Representative Johnson, is that an acceptable motion?
Yes.
Very well. Then Representative Long amends his motion that to be that House File 2806 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Long. We have one final item of business. This is Representative Mueller bill. Representative Mueller is extremely sick, and so she's not here today. And what I want to do is just very quickly do this. And this is members per agreement of leadership on both the major parties in this body that when a committee goes to the wrong jurisdiction that we can quickly move those over to appropriate committee. This bill concerns the court's recognition. This is House File 3603, by the way. And actually, I need to move it. So let me, I move, first of all, that to re-refer House File 3603 to the Committee on Judiciary without recommendation. And for the record, this bill primarily concerns the court's recognition of a foreign court orders. And in conversation with the Judiciary Chair, we thought this would best be heard in the Judiciary Committee. Whether or not this committee chooses to hear a bill hinges on some part to the degree on which a policy change has meaningful impact on law enforcement or corrections, in this case, law enforcement. As we reviewed the bill, the chair and I saw that police currently exercise the authority outlined in this bill with respect to countless other jurisdictions. And so, therefore, the conversation really is one that has to do with judiciary procedures. And so my motion then is to refer, in accordance with the chair of that committee, this bill, refer this bill to the Judiciary Committee. That's my motion. Discussion. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Members, thank you so much. Good hearing. Please have a good weekend. Well, good Friday and a good weekend. We'll see you all next week. This committee stands adjourned.